Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
I ask young people to put down your guns.
Lexington Mayor Linda Gorton at a City Hall press conference with Priscilla Sandifer, whose daughter was shot and killed last May while dropping off a friend at a party in Green Acres Park.
I still wake up in the middle of the night thinking that I'm hearing her walk up and down the steps.
And Dina Howard.
Every night, like Priscilla said, we have the visions of our child. My vision, the last vision I have of my son, is seeing him in the hospital room, eyes open, completely lifeless, staring up into the sky. And me being told that he was a crime scene and I couldn't touch him because he was still warm, but I couldn't touch him.
The press conference had been called to plead for safe end-of-year school celebrations and a safe summer, Mayor Gorton noting that recent months have seen a decline in gun deaths among young people.
That's good progress. However, we want that number to drop to zero. Zero.
The recent close-to-home mass shooting in Louisville raised new questions about Kentucky's relative lack of gun control laws. No waiting period after time of purchase. Nothing on the books about restricting untraceable firearms, also known as ghost guns. In fact, anybody over 21 who, under state and federal law, is eligible to lawfully possess a firearm may carry concealed deadly weapons in Kentucky. WEKU's John McGarry.
Kentucky's Black Legislative Caucus is asking the General Assembly to pass comprehensive gun reform legislation. State Representative George Brown of Lexington is chair of the caucus, and he was joined by other Black lawmakers in the Capitol Rotunda.
Our kids have the right to go to school in the morning and come home in the afternoon. People should be able to go to church and come home from church. Kids should be able to have a Sweet 16 party and come home from that party. We have an epidemic, I think, of gun violence in this country.
Brown said he and other members of the caucus also support the Tennessee Three, two of whom were briefly expelled from that state's legislature for violating decorum rules when they pleaded for gun reform.
We have more guns and more killings by use of guns than anywhere else in the country, in the world, actually. And so it's important for us to do the right thing as it relates to the safety and security of our citizens.
One gun reform pushed in the rotunda was a red flag law that would allow authorities to take guns away, at least temporarily, from people deemed dangerous.
WEKU's John McGarry. Gerald Smith, host of our series on racial justice and equality, continues the conversation with State Representative Brown.
Welcome to Eastern Standard, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. It is my pleasure to be with you today.
There has been much in the news about gun violence and mass killings in various parts of the country. And so, given the tragic and senseless killings that took place in Louisville not long ago, what are Kentucky's current gun laws?
From my position, Kentucky gun laws are non-existent as far as temperament and restraint. There are almost no restrictions to people being able to purchase a weapon in the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
I mean, is there anything there?
Without going through the statutes and seeing what's there, there's almost nothing there. The NRA and the gun makers have a real serious hold on the Commonwealth of Kentucky and the formulation of law. Also, as far as people are concerned, there's a misunderstanding of the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment says, and I know you know, Dr. Smith, that it says that in order to have a well-regulated militia, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed upon. And that's the mantra on which the last part of the Second Amendment is the part that everybody holds dear and say that they have a right. But the Second Amendment was framed in the late 18th century, and they had single-shot muskets. They didn't have automatic weapons that we have today.
So what are you doing to address this issue, and why is compromise so difficult on the issue of gun legislation?
I have filed bills for just about the whole time, filed or co-sponsored bills dealing with gun violence or and with common sense gun control and gun safety bills. Also red flag laws and background checks. And the thing that has happened because the Democrats are in the minority, we have not been able to get those bills assigned to committee and or heard by the in the House.
So why do you think compromise is so difficult? Why can't we get anything done?
Well, I think it's human nature. That what we've got is that the party that is now in the majority don't have to compromise. They have in the House, the Republicans have 80 members and the Democrats have 20 of 100. In the Senate of 38 members, there are only 8 Democrats. So they don't have to compromise. They don't have to have a conversation with us. They just shut us down, shut us off, and don't listen.
You know, our nation is severely divided on this issue of gun control. Do you believe race is a factor?
Race penetrates everything that we have going on in America. But I think that one of the things, what's occurring with the discussion about common sense gun control and with the red flag laws and the background checks and all those things that would help is an issue with America. From what I understand, and the statistics say that there are more guns in America, on the streets of America, than there are people. Problematic. People have made mistakes. A young man in Kansas City rings a doorbell and gets shot. Young people going to trying to find a party in upstate New York turn into a driveway, and a young lady is shot and killed. A group of cheerleaders in Texas mistakenly try to get in a car, and one young lady is seriously wounded, and other young teenagers that are shot. And one of the problems I think we have, Dr. Smith, is the stand your ground law in America that says you shoot first and ask questions later. If you feel threatened, you feel menaced, the guy in upstate New York that killed the young lady that they turned in her driveway said he felt menaced. How do you feel menaced when somebody is in your driveway or on your property, turn around and they're leaving and you fire several shots and kill a young person?
I asked you the question of whether or not you believed our nation was divided on the issue of gun control because of race or of whether or not race was a factor at all. Because one of the news reports that I've read recently is that Black and Hispanic Americans are more concerned about gun violence than whites. Why do you think that's the case?
A lot of what's happening, in the neighborhoods where we live, gun violence and incidents that occur with guns are prevalent. In my neighborhood, just recently, and I spoke to you about this, Dr. Smith, is that there were shots fired in my neighborhood. 3 of those shots hit and entered my home. Thank goodness I was the only person here, and I did not get injured. But only by the grace of God did that happen. So we can't. It is socioeconomics is where we live. But the gun violence issue is all around us, and we can't get away from it.
Our nation recently witnessed the expulsion of 2 Black state legislators in Tennessee because of their protest in the Capitol chamber over the killing of children in Nashville. So I want to ask you this question. If you and your colleagues held a similar protest, do you think you all would be expelled?
I think we could be expelled. And expulsion is going to the far end of what sanctions or punishment could be directed and or afforded to us. But we have had on occasion that mics have been cut off when leadership, the speaker or the leader, the speaker in the House or the leader in the Senate did not agree with the conversation, they can cut our mics off. So the alternative is to keep talking and potentially face sanctioning. And or the most severe thing would be to expel one of them.
Not long ago, you participated in a rally in Nashville. You want to talk about that experience?
It was actually an awesome experience to be in Nashville. Nashville is the only other place I ever lived when I went to, when I matriculated to Nashville to go to Tennessee State University. And it was an awesome day. It was an awesome day to have a connecting human chain from Vanderbilt Children's Hospital to the state capitol. And it was just awesome to spend time with the Justin Jones, who was from there in Davidson County, Nashville, and with Justin Pearson, who is from Memphis. And his district happens to also be the place where the Lorraine Motel is, where Dr. King was assassinated 50 years ago.
You know, some people seem to think more guns, less crime. Others would say, you know, more guns, more crime. How do we, as a country, address, you know, problems with ghost guns or gun trafficking?
It's a difficult situation. We have not reached that tipping point that says that enough is enough, and that we're going to, as a nation, stand up and start to do things differently. And we may be a ways off, and those of us, and I'm a baby boomer, you are probably in the late baby boomer age, but the article that I just read today in CNN that talked about what happened in Tennessee and what's happening going forward, I think is that the demographics are changing in America, and that we've got to know and understand that there are issues that deal with age and demographics and how young people see the world and see our country, and how those of us that are older see the world and see our country.
A recent CBS poll reported that more than 75% of parents are concerned about possible gun violence at their child's school. You just made a comment that, you know, we haven't reached the point where enough is enough. It seemed like, you know, we're past that point where we're saying enough is enough. So what do we do then? I mean, what can citizens who believe that something must be done to address this national crisis do to make a difference?
I think, and this is just purely my thought, is that people who are about making substantive and positive change on this issue must stand up. And they must stand up in huge numbers. And they must stand up, and there must be a public outcry that we have never heard in this country before. And it requires every day dealing with and addressing the issue of gun violence and the proliferation of guns in our society, that we have got to start talking about it all the time and say that it is not okay for our children to go to school in the morning and not come home at night. It is not okay for our children to go to a Sweet 16 birthday party and not come home after that party. It is not okay to go to school, to church, or to the grocery store, or to go out in society at large and have your life snuffed out simply because somebody has a gun. I would look at it, and I didn't live in this time, but, you know, the Wild Wild West, everybody had a gun. Everybody, almost, you never know who has a gun today. We have the permitless carry, open carry, concealed carry, that people have the right to in this country. And then we have the Sandra Brown law. I mean, anything that could happen, a mistake or you trip and touch someone's belongings or touch their person, and that could be the last mistake that you make.
That's 77th District State Representative George Brown, Jr. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
We requested interviews for this segment with Senate President Robert Stivers and House Speaker David Osborne. Senator Stivers declined. We did not hear from Speaker Osborne, but hope to hear from both legislative leaders in the near future. There are many voices out there in search of civil conversations about social justice. Eastern Standard's Crystal Jones heard from some of them in Berea.
Each year in April since 1970, Earth Day has been raising awareness for global environmental issues with organized cleanups, mass plantings, and even a festival or two. On sort of a side note, April also happens to be the kickoff month for festival season in Kentucky. And this year, I was fortunate enough to celebrate both at one event, where I met some local people who are investing in the issues year-round.
Most people know me as Etheria Luna. My actual name is Amber Schaefer, and I am the founder of Berea Earth Warriors.
Berea Earth Warriors is a community volunteer group who hosts a number of awareness-based festivals at Owl Eyes Farm, just outside of the Berea city limits. We step inside the residence of venue owner Ed, who is outside taking in the music of the local band, The New Developments. The smell of pulled pork and cotton candy linger on the crisp air. Friday's lineup was canceled due to weather, and this morning there are precautionary tarps and towels at hand as the crowd steadily grows with today's warming sun.
We mostly do litter recovery and natural area restoration. Our main project is the Owsley Reservoir, which is where Berea's drinking water comes from. And to date, we have pulled over 3,000 pounds of trash and dumped furniture and tires from Owsley Reservoir. We have the Growing Good Garden, which is a partnership between Berea Earth Warriors and Berea Food Bank.
They also host the concert series, whose underlying focus is to promote environmental education for families while showcasing local musical acts.
Mighty Shades of Ebony, which is a social and environmental activist group out of Louisville, and they are just some of the most talented kids I've ever seen. And we definitely are going to have them back for our future events because our causes are very much aligned. And, you know, we're trying to bring groups from all over the state and get the word out there for people to get out and participate and enjoy events like this.
This group of young, self-described edutainers uses a combination of artistry and activism as a way to talk about global and local issues from environmental to social justice. Their performance gets an ovation from a crowd that was already on its feet for their set. After the show, I had a chance to speak with the group about their experience in the program.
I'm Heath Griffin, and I am 13 years old.
Hello, my name is Malachi Pettigrew. I am 12 years old.
Hello, my name is Special K, but you can call me Cameron, and I am 13-year-old.
My name is Joseph Page. I am a 15-year-old at Atherton High School.
Hello, my name is Ian Heck. I'm 13 years old, and I go to Du Bois Academy.
A nonprofit whose founders, Chris Rashid, and his two children, Cam and Jay, consist of young men and women who are passionate about their planet and fellow humans, and devoted to learning how to effectively communicate them through the Justice League.
Hello, I'm Chris Rashid. They nicknamed me Professor R. Why it's called a league is because it's a conglomeration of a lot of different groups. Why we say justice is because at the heart of justice is education.
Developed during the pandemic, the students would spend a few hours a week online discussing and researching topics important to them. These are serious issues, even for adults. Talking about things like inequality, mental health, and availability of resources. Things young people have to take into consideration on a much larger scale than previous generations. Most of the members aren't old enough to vote yet, but the same issues that appear on candidates' podiums at the debates are lingering in their young minds too. And since the adults in the room don't always seem to be listening, they've started their own conversation, and it's set to a very different beat.
Yo, DJ, kick that beat.
If love is the answer,
answer.
Life is a test.
Test, test, test.
That's okay.
If love is the answer, then what is the question? If life is a test,
what is the lesson?
Justice League gives the student activist a safe and open place to learn how to have the discussions and how to put into context all the information available to them.
So what they did was they study things that they care about, and then they learn how to extrapolate that through using Bloom's taxonomy. What is the lowest level of learning?
Knowledge.
What's the highest?
Creativity.
So these are professionals. And that's when we went to Frankfurt, they branched out without me. I stayed in the cafeteria and ate breakfast. They went out and had their conversations, took notes.
From those notes, they compose the lyrics that reflect their concerns, experiences, and most importantly, from the perspective of others their age.
Rapping is basically just like a poem because you can learn more about like the history and past, but also in a musical way that helps musicians and also other people get more an interactive form of learning.
And how does it make you feel, you guys, to be young and get the opportunity to go out and speak for these causes and speak for yourself? And
it makes me feel amazing because, like, having people that love me and support me around me, like having people just to be there when I'm at my lowest and my highest, just it's life changing.
It like he said, it just feels life changing, and it's wonderful to kind of just do it in a hip hop way and rap about what we're about and what we need to change in this world.
You can see photos and find links to learn more about Justice League LOU and Mighty Shades of Ebony on our Facebook page. For Eastern Standard, this is Crystal Jones.
Coming up after the break, time keeps revealing more and more about the horror of being caught in the big Eastern Kentucky flash flood of last July. We'll have one of those discoveries plus one possible solution. Kentucky author Jonathan Green joins us, and some thoughts about one of Kentucky's riches, its writers. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
I'm Brian Burkhart with coming events provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Musician Pokey LaFarge will perform live at Frankfurt's Grand Theater at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, May 20th. To purchase tickets and for more information, visit thegrandky.com. The Appalachian Center for the Arts presents the premiere of the movie Crazy Game of Poker, 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 18th. Find out more about this film and purchase tickets at theapp.org. The Governor's Derby exhibit, presented by the Kentucky Arts Council, runs through May 16th at the State Capitol in Frankfort. The exhibit's theme is resilience. The Governor's Derby exhibit is open to the public during regular Capitol visiting hours. For more information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
It's been 9 months since the big storm and flash flood of last July caused so much death and destruction in southeastern Kentucky, and we're still discovering its impacts. From WMMT in Whitesburg, Parker Hobson looks into one of them.
For Ted Link, who lives in Hindman, the worst part of last summer's catastrophic flood might not have been the flooding itself, but the days after.
I was really sick. I was getting sick.
Ted has type 2 diabetes, and so to regulate his blood sugar, he needs to take insulin, which he keeps in the fridge. But he lost power during the flood, so there went the fridge. On top of that, Ted is new to having diabetes, so he wasn't sure at the time if his insulin would still be okay after it got warm. So he stopped taking it. And it wasn't long before he started to feel the consequences of uncontrolled blood sugar.
My mind was racing like a race car. And my body, though, I felt sluggish and I just wanted to sleep.
To make matters worse, Ted and everyone else at his housing complex in Hindman was largely cut off from help after the flood.
We had no food, we had no water, we had no power, we had no internet, we had nothing. And none of us here drive, so none of us could get out to where the services were.
So Ted needed insulin help, and quick. Enter Alice Cottle from the Kentucky River District Health Department. After the flood, Alice was out delivering food and checking in on people all over the county. She stopped into Ted's housing complex on a hunch they might need some help. And lucky for Ted, she also just so happened to be a diabetes educator.
He didn't know really that I was a diabetes educator, but since I was bringing food, he said, "Do you know anything about storing insulin?" And here I could answer his question.
Alice was able to tell Ted that even after it got warm, his particular kind of insulin would still be okay to take for 28 days.
And he also told me that he hadn't been eating. He said, "I'm afraid I'll have a low blood sugar." I was never so happy to feed someone.
After the third day, I finally got something, you know, and I took the medicine and got something. But it was 48 hours, almost 3 days, without insulin and without medicine and without food.
While the details of Ted's story and not knowing about his insulin might be unique, he was just one of thousands in East Kentucky who went without medication or access to care in the days and weeks after the flood, due to the serious isolation that was caused by the destruction of vehicles, roads, and bridges, all of which stranded many people wherever they were. And that on top of widespread power outages and internet outages. And when it comes to diabetes in particular, the flood hit this region hard. East Kentucky has higher rates of type 2 than the state and national averages, and many diabetics in the region, like Ted, either lost their insulin or diabetic supplies, or got cut off from help, or both. But after the water went down, it was this very problem that some Letcher County health workers set about trying to solve.
And it kind of reminded me of Hurricane Katrina, when people were stuck on their housetops saying, "I need help, I need help." And we kind of had that here. So that's when we realized that we had to do something quick.
Mindy Boggs is a community health worker with Mountain Comprehensive Health Corporation, or MCHC, in Letcher County, which was also hit hard by the flood. On a normal day, her job involves going door to door to check in every week on a set of local diabetic patients to make sure they have the supplies, the support, and the knowledge they need to stay healthy. Many of these are people who might not get the care they need otherwise, so her job was important already. And then came the flood.
Yeah, because a lot of people went at least 4 or 5 days without power. So that insulin, even if they didn't lose their home, they probably still lost their insulin because most of it has to be kept in the refrigerator. So a lot of them, even if they could get out or didn't get affected by the flood, they still lost their insulin.
It's not just their insulin, but it's supplies they need, whether it be syringes or pin needles and glucometers and test strips and continuous glucose meters.
And this is Mary Collins, a nurse practitioner and diabetes specialist who works closely with Mindy at MCHC to care for their diabetic patients. We first spoke with Mindy and Mary late last summer. The flood spared Mary's house, but it did destroy both of the bridges that were the only way in and out of her home community of McRoberts in Letcher County. So Mary was stuck at home without cell phone service.
When the floodwaters hit, that was what broke my heart, was my patients need something and I can't give it to them.
Stuck as she was, though, Mary was able to borrow a neighbor's phone to check in with Mindy, whose house was okay and who was still able to get around. As they shared their experiences of the day and started to put together just how huge the scope of the flood was, they realized that diabetics in the community were about to need a lot of support, especially in needing insulin and other supplies. So they thought they'd try putting an ask out on social media just to see if they might get any bites.
I think my first Facebook post was, "If you have diabetes supplies, message me. If you need diabetes supplies, message me."
Before they knew it, messages started rolling in. In some cases, it was nearby pharmacies or even medical supply companies who were offering to donate extra insulin or supplies. But in a bunch of cases, it was just regular people wanting to help out.
We had a lady from London, Kentucky call, and she had insulin pump supplies. But she said, "I don't have any insulin to go in them." But then the next morning, we had a lady from West Virginia call, and she said, "I have insulin, but I don't have any pods." And I'm like, "That's great, because the pods are coming from London. The insulin's coming from West Virginia. We're going to meet in the middle." And so we did. We got the pods from, we ended up with a lot of pods.
We did.
And a lot of insulin came. And so it worked out great. So we were really lucky. Within a day,
yes,
we were able to start getting insulin out into the hands of the people who needed it.
As you can probably guess, with donations coming in from all over like that, managing everything was a complex logistical operation. On the delivery end, there were lots of different people involved and lots of moving parts. But also, with the flood destroying so much transportation infrastructure, getting around within the flood zone was dicey in many places and near impossible in others. And to make things even harder, many of the patients who needed help were cut off from communication, so they could be hard to find.
A lot of it was word of mouth. If I talked to one patient and I knew they were without insulin, I'm like, "Who else do you know that may need insulin?" Just being out house to house, home to home. That's kind of how it all evolved. It was just Mary made those calls and got stuff rolling, and then I started delivering. Monday after the flood, is when the clinic was back in full swing. And we have another community healthcare worker that works with us too. And so we teamed up and we just loaded our cars with food and insulin and monitor kits and whatever we thought they would need, and just kind of just went through the community handing out whatever we could, wherever we could get to. A few places I couldn't get to, a few places I shouldn't have went. But
in their normal work lives, Mary and Mindy just work with diabetics who are patients at MCHC. But in the weeks after the flood, they sort of just started helping everybody.
A lot of times I'll be next door to somebody, and I'll, as I go out the door or something, I'll say, you guys need anything? And that'll start, yeah, I'm out of my medication. Can you figure out how to do this? So normally we do just diabetic patients, but since the flood, we've been kind of doing checks on everybody that we can.
We've joked that we've adopted all the little mamas and papas.
It's been great. We found homes that we didn't know existed and people we didn't know existed, and we've been able to help those people too with a lot of times just food supplies or whatever, not just their insulin.
Mindy and Mary casting a wide net like this was a big deal, in part because health professionals would tell you that, even before the flood, one of the huge barriers to better health in East Kentucky was that a lot of people lacked reliable transportation. And there were many people, like customers of the Neon Pharmacy in Letcher County, for example, who relied on medication getting delivered to them.
Neon Pharmacy was a lot with my patients because they delivered. So when Neon got flooded, there went their pharmacy. And so even if they didn't get flooded, and even if they could get a hold of us, their pharmacy didn't have the insulin and they had no way of getting to us. So we were able to, through those donations and stuff, we were able to take it out and say, here's you a month's worth of insulin.
When they step back and reflect on this whole effort, Mindy and Mary say something special about it was just how many people reached out to help.
I had a patient who lost everything but came into the clinic to check on us to see if we needed help. And I thought that's a prime example of our people.
They also got donations not just from within the region, but also from all over the country.
The farthest was California.
Yeah. We had some come from New York City.
Yep.
We said it was kind of like Christmas because we had these Amazon boxes that
yes.
just came in with the, you know, addresses on them, and we would kind of pass them around. There's four of us there, and each one of us would take a box and open it and see what we got today. You know, I opened a box, and it was full of pumps, and I was like, I don't even know what this one is, Mary. But you'd be surprised how many people who have roots in Letcher County or
yes.
Eastern Kentucky, and they all reached out. So it was just like word of mouth. Everybody just started reaching out. Family started reaching in, because, you know, we always say once you're in the mountains, you're always from the mountains. And so they just started reaching out, and I have extra. What can I do to help?
At this point, of course, it's been more than half a year since the flood. But when it comes to diabetes, people across the region are still dealing with different issues and disruptions the flood caused that have made managing blood sugar even harder. Like maybe you lost your kitchen or your whole house, and so your routine had to change, and you found yourself eating more fast food and processed food. Or maybe you've had to spend weeks or months working on your house, which also affected your diet or put strain on your body. Or maybe you've just been plain stressed. When we spoke to Mindy and Mary late last summer, they said all of this stuff can show up in your blood sugar.
When you find out you're a diabetic, it's a huge lifestyle adjustment. So when you make that huge lifestyle adjustment, along with it comes some depression, some denial, some troubles in that area. And then you add that flood in there too. And so it's been stress and anxiety and depression and all that. And that's something we're going to have to work on ongoing. And a lot of mine who were doing what I considered very well for them, their blood sugars are going back up now, or they're getting what I call wonky blood sugars.
Yeah.
We're dropping low when we didn't have lows, or we're going too high when we didn't have highs. And a lot of that is the stress and worry from the flood. You know, a couple of them lost everything they had in the flood. And so that's something that I'm watching out for with the patients I see.
From WMMT in Whitesburg, I'm Parker Hobson for Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Are there solutions to diabetes in nutrition, in sticking to a healthy diet? There are, but that's easy to say if you live where fresh produce and healthy foods are readily available. That's not always the case, especially in rural areas of the Commonwealth. Alison Gustafson, a professor in UK's College of Agriculture, Food and Environment, is getting ready to launch an experimental grocery prescription program. We wanted to know more. How does the grocery prescription program work?
There's two different ones that we're testing, and we're super excited about our partnerships. One is with Instacart, and so we'll be looking at that among women who are pregnant, who have either gestational diabetes or type 2 diabetes, and they will participate in our pilot study, and they'll receive $50 per week to sign into Instacart, and they'll get healthy foods that are tailored for combating high blood sugar, and they'll get that food delivered to their door per week for 12 weeks. And then we're also working with Food City, which is in the eastern part of our state, and it's a grocery store out there. And they have meal box kits, and they're designed, again, for helping to manage hypertension and high blood sugar or blood glucose. And people will sign up online, and they will be able to pick up a meal kit, which is about 5 lunches and 5 dinners, approximately similar, $50 a week, and they'll go to the store and pick that up. And so we're going to see, does that help? Does that help reduce food insecurity? And does it also help reduce high blood sugar and reduce healthcare costs?
It seems likely that it will. What about when the program ends? 3 months, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a great point. And this is one of our key partners, again, just to bring that up. The Kentucky Association of Health Plans has been an integral partner, and they are our main funder of these 4 statewide projects. And that's what they want to see. So this Kentucky Association of Health Plans connect all of our major managed care organizations. So every managed care organization has committed to understanding what works and what doesn't. So we'll be presenting our results to these key leaders and saying these are the programs that work, that are effective, not only clinically, but cost-wise. And then we'll look at a longer-term implementation plan of these programs for who and for how long, reimbursed through the insurance. That's our ultimate goal, is that these will be reimbursed through your healthcare provider.
Now, you mentioned type 2 diabetes. Of course, that's very prevalent in our coverage area. How do you address the disease in your work?
We do quite a bit. We do obviously a lot with nutrition education and intervention work. But what we're trying to really do now with this program is providing food, but also, if you've heard the term, behavioral nudges. So it's one thing to say, oh, I have this food, I've picked up a meal kit, or I've picked up, you know, a produce prescription, but maybe you're not sure how to cook with it. So we're providing through text messaging, you know, through AI, through some of those technology resources, but then also face-to-face with cooperative extension, skills and resources for how to cook with that meal, and then also food coping strategies. So for how to structure that food longer in your household, whether it be through leftovers or looking at recipes for how to use, you know, your beef in 2 different ways or your pork products in 2 different ways. And then we also are trying to address transportation as well. And so some of these, we're hoping at the end of the day, eventually we'd be able to offer meal kit delivery to people's homes that need it.
How can people participate in the program?
Right now, we are still in the early stages, meaning we're getting all of the paperwork in order. So Appalachian Regional Healthcare, so ARH, is our clinical provider. And as you can imagine, sometimes we need to collect clinical data, and we need to get all the authorities to agree to us collecting that data. But what we would love, if anyone is interested in participating in the study, which will be starting in the next, probably 4 months, it'll be starting in 4 months, they can email me or they can go to our website. And that way they can connect with us, and we will put them on a roster or like a list of people that are interested in participating.
Okay. And give us your email and that website. We'll also put those on our website, so it could be referred to there.
Our website, it's a little long, but here we go. foodashealthalliance.ca.uky.edu. And if that's too hard, my last name is also hard, but we'll give it a go. It's Alison, A-L-I-S-O-N, and then .Gustafson, G-U-S-T-A-F-S-O-N, at uky.edu.
Got it. Okay, Alison Gustafson, director of the Food as Health Alliance and professor in UK's College of Agriculture, Food and Environment. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
If I don't love you, baby, grits ain't groceries, eggs ain't poultry, and no release of words of man.
Jonathan Green is Tom Eblen's latest guest in his series on Kentucky literature.
Jonathan Green is a poet, book designer, and publisher. Born in New York City, he earned a degree in literature from Bard College and studied poetry with Robert Lowell. Since 1966, he and his wife, artist Aubrey Adams, have lived on an isolated farm on the Kentucky River near Frankfort. Green founded Noman Press in 1965 and over the next five decades published more than 60 books. Many of those books were pivotal to the careers of writers and photographers who are now considered Kentucky icons. Among them, Wendell Berry, James Still, Jim Wayne Miller, Harlan Hubbard, Richard Taylor, Ed McClanahan, Gurney Norman, and the photographers Ralph Eugene Meatyard and Guy Mendes. Jonathan Green also is a well-regarded poet. Several of his poems have been featured on Garrison Keillor's popular daily podcast, The Writer's Almanac. His poetry has been praised by such poets as Wendell Berry and former U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser. Jonathan Green is celebrating his 80th birthday this spring by releasing his 40th collection of poetry, Going Through It, published by Broadstone Books in Frankfort. It's a great sampling of his work. Short, tightly written free verse that comments on life and all its wonder and absurdity. Jonathan Green is with us today. Jonathan, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks a lot. Hey.
Well, tell us a little about your latest book and how it came about.
Well, it's because the previous Broadstone book, Ebb and Flow, was about to go out of print, and I didn't want to see all those poems vanish. And I had another collection done in Vermont last year, and I had maybe a third or more than were in those books, so I just thought I would put them all together, and I came up with this, which I think is exactly 102 pages.
Yeah. Well, what do you think makes a good poem?
To me, any piece of writing has to be interesting and unique and maybe go to a place that hasn't been touched on before. And actually, you mentioned a lot of the poems are short, but actually, this book has one poem that even goes over a page, but most people concentrate on the short poems. And in fact, I did an anthology with another person that just concentrated on short poems. I hardly remember any of my poems, but there was one poem that was easy because there's only two words.
Yeah, well, some poets need a page to clear their throats, so you just never know. Well, what brought you to Kentucky all those years ago?
In 1961, I met a couple who lived, well, when I met them, they lived on Gratz Park in Lexington. He was an artist. He was sort of a Renaissance man. He was a printer. He was one of the last people in the world to design his own typeface, cut his own typeface, and print from it, and sell it, actually. And he was Austrian, and his name was Victor Hammer. He taught at Transy. And when I met them in 61, I just continued being friends with them. And that was actually the impetus of moving here. Hmm. And they were good friends of Thomas Merton, and their collection of their correspondence was published recently.
Right. Yeah. Well, what was it about book publishing philosophy that attracted so many great Kentucky writers and photographers to work with you? What was it about your system or methods?
Well, I just knew about it and knew certain circumstances. I mean, my best-selling book that Noman Press has ever done was Gurney Norman's Kinfolks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it sold by now like 23,000 copies. And I knew about this manuscript that Random House was supposed to publish. And the editor died in a car wreck, I think, in New Jersey. And so I knew it was there and didn't have an advocate anymore at Random House. So they were no longer keen on publishing it. He didn't have a contract yet. So that's how I went and edited what I ended up doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great book of stories for anyone who hasn't read it.
Well, what do you think makes a well-designed book? Because you're also very well known as a book designer.
Well, it has to be, has to use good type, and somebody should know what they're doing. And once again, sometimes I end up using typefaces that aren't that well known. And then I've actually, through the Homers, I've met a number of other type designers besides Victor. I met, well, the most famous from the 20th century is Hermann Zoff. I met through them. He designed Palatino, I guess, is his most famous face, and Optima. Through them, I met the biographer of Hermann Zoff and a number of other typeface designers. And, you know, you have to have a keen eye. In poetry, a lot of times, the leading, which is the space between the lines, it's a hot type term that's, I think, still used. And mm-hmm. a lot of times, that's not, the size of the type and the leading, the space between the lines, is not what I would think is the best. But people, I'm not sure how many people see the fine points and how many don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Kinfolks. What other books are you most proud of?
Well, you know, I published the first book of photographs of Jean Meteorin, and that was 1970. I designed his second book, which is Unforeseen Wilderness, about the Red River Gorge with Wendell's text. And then he died, and I did one catalog after he died. And I think also my book influenced the book that Aperture did afterwards. I corresponded with the publisher of Aperture about Gene's work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just, I guess, you know, lucky to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Well, you know, after six decades in the Kentucky literary scene, what are some of the major changes you've seen?
Well, of course, everything has changed in both books. And I mean, the major change is, of course, the internet and the whole digital world. I mean, when I started, you would never be able to publish and print a book. Well, the baseline would be like 1,000 copies. And if it was 500 copies, you'd have to have a huge price on it because it was so low. And right. Now people do books 100 copies, or it's just digital, and the book doesn't exist until you order it, and then they print one copy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a complete change in that respect.
Well, what about the writers? I mean, you've worked with so many great Kentucky writers over the years. What kind of changes have you seen in the talent and the type of things that they write about? And
part of turning 80 is I don't follow all the young writers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know names more than I know all the books they've published. You know, somebody like Silas House, I knew when he first started out, mostly because he went to Hyman Settlement School, and I used to be down there every summer at the writer's workshop.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. It's a really fine read for anyone who loves poetry. Once again, it's called Going Through It by Jonathan Green, published by Broadstone Books in Frankfurt. Jonathan, thanks for being with us today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
For a state with myriad issues on the education front, Kentucky certainly does have its fair share of great writers. Special Topics reporter Chris Begley has had that on his mind.
We just inaugurated the new Kentucky Poet Laureate. Silas House assumed that role, passed on from Crystal Wilkinson. That made me think about how many fantastic writers we have here, people whose work is known and respected around the world. I think of Gurney Norman, Bobby Ann Mason, Hunter Thompson, Nicky Finney, Robert Penn Warren, Barbara Kingsolver, Wendell Berry, and I could just keep going on and on. Why do we have so many good writers? I wondered what that means and why it seems to matter to me. I assume that any population is pretty similar in terms of its ability, creativity, and so forth. So what has happened here? Maybe it has to do with how we categorize literature in such a way that Appalachian writers or Southern writers are singled out and might get more attention? Could it be the education system here? Is it the great writing programs that we have at several universities across the Commonwealth? Or is it the strong community of writers that exist in so many of our communities that help and encourage each other? Maybe it's something about the place, the unique history, the beauty of the mountains or the bluegrass, or the hardships that many face, or maybe the way the geography shapes how and where we live. I know that place is important here as much as anywhere else, and that much of the literature I'm familiar with features place as an important part of the work. Or is it that we have so many writers and artists in every size and type of community across the Commonwealth that it occurs to us that we might be one, too? We see ourselves represented in that group. Kentucky is not a paragon of diversity, but we see more and more of our people represented by the artists we celebrate, and that matters. Also, here in Kentucky, artist is not incompatible with other occupations. It's not a novelty that we have a farmer who is a writer or the other way around. And of course, it's not just writers we have, it's musicians, painters, photographers, sculptors, dancers, and storytellers. We seem to understand that these things are not extra or frivolous or less important, but are fundamental to our ability to survive and thrive as a group. That's why we have what we have. It doesn't just happen. We nurture it. And if we don't, we won't have it anymore. When I think about why it matters to me that we have so many writers and artists of all types, it comes back to place and community. It makes me proud of where I'm from and who we are. And in the face of many things we're not proud of, it gives me faith in the community and a reason to fight to make it better. And as proud as I might be of the accomplishment of these writers, it's even better to know that our community helped that happen. Thank you all for that.
Special Topics reporter Chris Begley is the author of The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. You can hear him speak, along with Silas House, at the Kentucky Great Writers Series at the Carnegie Center in Lexington on May 23rd. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on the WEKU app, on NPR One, or anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.